legends, and welcome to Unbeatable You, where we connect, thrive, and conquer. I'm your host, Brett Robbo, and I'm super grateful for your valuable time. So let's just dive straight in. Keep thriving and enjoy. Keep going. We'll just, that's what the podcast will be all about. I didn't know you had a singing career in you, but take it.
I wish. Well, not me here doing swimming.
Oh. Grant Scooter Patterson, you bloody legend. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure and an absolute honour to have you here in the studio today, mate. We've been connected through the Paralympic world, really, and we're just sort of discussing before we started recording. We were at the London 2012 Paralympics together at the same time, even though we didn't meet and we didn't cross paths. We've been in the Paralympic world at the same time in many of the same places. And I know you as a Paralympic swimmer, but I also have been exposed to a different side of Grant Scooter Patterson recently, listening to you on podcasts and with your motivational speaking. So super keen to dive into all elements of your story today. I'd love to kick it off by how would you explain who is Grant Scooter Patterson?
In three words, short, funny, smelly guy. Short, I fart a lot, right, and make jokes.
Okay. Have you had your gut health tested, mate? Farting is a sign of just a bit of gut dysbiosis.
Yeah, I think I'm like a garbage truck. Everything comes out. But no, that's whenever I do my swimming profile on the website, it always says, you know, describe yourself. And I always put that. And my mum's like, why'd you put smelly guy on there for?
All right.
Not going to meet any women.
So apart from short, smelly and funny, how else would you describe yourself?
Well, someone who doesn't say no to a challenge. When I do my talks, I talk about how life is like a hand of cards in a poker game. We all get dealt a different hand of cards at birth. A lot of people say, I got dealt a crap hand. I like to say challenging hand. In life, we all have choices on whether or not to fold, call, or to raise. Fold is to admit defeat, not giving yourself any chances in life to reach your full potential. Call is to sit back in life and play the safe card. And raise is the one that I play every week, week in, week out, is go out on a limb and make something from nothing. And I think me doing what I do in the swimming world and in my personal life, I like to demonstrate and also inspire not just disabled people but everyone in life in general to get off your ass and go have a go.
Brilliant. Just for everyone listening, explain why it's a challenging card for you that you've been dealt.
Well, if you look at what I look like, I'm about 3'12". I say midget. A lot of people with a short stature don't like the word midget. We'll talk about that later. But I'm born with a rare form of dwarfism called dystrophic dysplasia, a bit of a tongue twister. And it's pretty much, in layman terms, I'm a messed up midget. I've got lots of curvature in my bones. My spine has kyphosis and a scoliosis, so it's like a roller coaster off movie world. And then all my joints have got like a mild form of arthritis, like an older person. And to do what I do every day, get up out of bed, go training early, go to work, go back to training, it's difficult. But I don't, you know, when I wake up in the morning, I might have sore joints, but I don't let that stop me because, you know, my dream at the moment is to hopefully go to Paris and try and win that gold medal. I've got a Paralympic medal, a silver and a bronze, but I want that gold. And then me doing that is going to obviously display lots of good examples in life of how other people can chase their dreams. Seeing someone, well, I don't know if disadvantage is the right word, but yeah, it's definitely a hard hand of cards to live life with. It's not easy.
How was your upbringing? And was it always this kind of mindset that you have to approach life in that way, in that kind of abundance and optimistic aspect?
No, but I am very lucky. I'd like to say I'm very lucky being put on this life with my two parents, Shelley and Stephen. It's nearly like winning the lottery. No joke. Like, I've got a lot of mates out there that don't have problems, and they just don't get life, and they don't understand, you know, how to get forward or how to set goals for something and achieve, like, you know, buy a house or hold a full-time job. They don't have common sense like that. And it's a big thanks to my two parents, Shelley and Stephen, for not wrapping me up in bubble wrap. There's a lot of parents out there that have a kid with a disability and they think, oh, he's missing an arm or he's missing a leg or he can't talk, he can't contribute to the rest of the world. Well, they're wrong. There's always a way around something. Like when I got here this morning, there's two flights of stairs up into this room. You know, a lot of other people with disability, oh, no, I can't do that. But the way I've been brought up, there's always a way around things. And don't let things stop you. And in my house at home, all the light switches, bench tops, it's all the same as how you'd have yours. What I've done is when I'm in the kitchen, I've got like a hairdressing stool, so it goes up and down, and that's how I buzz around the kitchen. I adapt to society because if I change to, well, if I make it all to fit me when I go away, another example, when you met me in the car and you saw my peg leg,
yep.
I wouldn't be able to drive a rental car to get here today.
Mm.
You would have come and got me.
Yeah. And how is it when you pull up and ask for a rental car and you got a peg leg thing that they want to, you got to put on to the pedals to extend up to reach your short legs?
Yeah, I think I need to do a body video on that, a documentary, because whenever I go into a rental company, I walk in there and they can't see me because I'm behind the desk. Oh, hello, hello, down here. And then they look over, oh, how can we help you? I'm here to pick up a car under Grant Patterson. Oh, okay. And, oh, we need your license, please, hoping that I don't have one. Throw it up on the desk. And then they have a look at it. Oh, it's real. It's not out of a cereal box. And then they go, do you want insurance? No. Sure? Yep. But, yeah, their face is pretty heroic. It's pretty funny.
Back to your upbringing and the way that you were treated, I think that's a really good point to make because I coached and treated in Paralympic sport for a lot of years. And when I was coaching, when I would do scouting for younger Paralympic athletes, I could tell the kids that were brought up in cotton wool compared to the kids that were treated like they didn't have a disability and that they were given opportunities as they would if they were able-bodied. And I say this without judgment to the parents because I'm a parent now of a two-year-old and a four-year-old and I can completely understand how parents do it. But from your experience and what you see, do you think that that is a big part of the reason why other people with a disability might not have the same optimistic, go-get-it type attitude as you?
100% correct. I see it on pool decks all the time.
So you see it a lot in your sport?
I see it with people that aren't disabled. Mm. They run in and put little Jimmy's goggles on. What are you doing? Get off the pool deck. This is a coach's spot. Coaches and swimmers, no parents out there. I remember when I was little, you know, we might be doing an activity with scouts or who knows, something. And they would say, oh, does Grant need this? And my dad or my mum would say, oh, no, Grant will ask us for help if he needs help. I said, that's how he has to learn. And I'll tell you what, I'm not a parent, but you're a parent. And what you said before, you can see how it happens, how you just immediately, oh, come here, Jessica, I'll put your cap on and I'll do that. It's so easy for you to do that because your sibling that you created is struggling. But it's better for them if you do nothing and let them find out how to do it themselves because when they're 18 and they're in a position, like I've been in lots of positions where I've got no one around to help, I can get through it. Mm. And sit there and cry and go, oh, I need help and give up. I never give up. Let me give you an example. When I was training for the Ironman in 2015.
You did an Ironman?
Yep, half Ironman, 70.3. Crazy, I know.
17.3.
Half, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So that's 1.9K swim, 90K ride, 21K run.
Fair.
And it first started off at a club presentation night. Someone said, oh, you can't do that, Scooter. And because I have a problem in my head when someone says I can't do something, I have to do it. And I'm like, oh, don't say that. Anyway, I'm training for this, and I'm on the bike, and I'm going up to a place in Cairns called rocks or something. Anyway, there's a really steep short hill climb to get into it, and then it's a long 7 kilometer ascent. Anyway, the first bit, so you go up the mountain and then you come down, and as you're coming down, there's probably like a 20 meter drop where it's like, I don't know, maybe 60 degrees gradient. It's like nearly, I thought it was 90 degrees, but it was steep. And I remember going in, going, how the hell am I going to get out? And I said, well, think about that when we come back. So anyway, I did the 7 kilometers up and then come back. And when I was coming back, I could see the hill in front of me about, you know, 500 meters away. And I said, I think the only way we're going to do this is if we give it full stick. So I'm in the top gear, got like, I don't know, 35 k's an hour, pedal, hoping the car doesn't come down because it's only one lane. Anyway, I'm going for it and I'm halfway up and I'm like, oh, I've got to go down gears because I'm, you know, when you're in a high gear going up a hill, you fall off. So I've went down a little bit more. Anyway, it was too steep and I'm on the hill going, I got nothing left, and I'm strapped into it because your feet are clipped into clips. I'm like, over we go. So we've fallen over in the middle of the road on the steep hill and I've got no phone reception because we're in the sticks where I was. And in my head I'm like, how am I going to get out of here? See, we're on a really steep hill. Cars could come down any moment. I'm by myself. What's going to happen? Anyway, pulled the bike into the bush. I had a piss while I was there. Hopped back on the bike. And so when I'm on the bike, I'm facing the road horizontal, so I'm flat at the moment, and I'm leaning on the tree because I couldn't touch. Anyway, I've hopped off, pushed off the tree, and my idea was to go on the hill and go a little bit down to get my foot in and then pedal up the rest of it. So I've done that, gone down a little bit and pedal it. And as I'm going back up the steep bit, my right foot's come out, and I'm like, fuck. So I got left foot going, push, push, push. And it was like 100 metres up the steep bit, and I did it with one leg. And if there was anyone else listening, they would have thought someone was dying because I'm like, come on, move your ass. But that was a moment for me of not giving up because I needed to get out of there.
Brilliant.
I wasn't dying, but like the only way I was getting out is cycling out.
And that wasn't part of the race though. That was part of your training.
Just training.
How long did the race take you?
So I remember when we first started talking about the Ironman, we predicted about 9 hours 30 and the cutoff was 8 hours. I ended up doing the whole 70.3 in 7 hours 48. So
well done.
Over the moon.
Well done.
Yeah. I was beating people with the arms and legs, so that was pretty cool.
Yeah. Well done. Do you put that down to the training or the determination?
Determination. And I've got a video on YouTube, you can watch it later, but it's just, as Herbie talks on there, and there was another fellow that helped me with the cycling, and he pretty much says, I don't need any propping up, I just get out there and go, because the only thing that, well, the thing that I'm really good at is committing to something and giving it 151%, which is very good, but also sometimes can be a little bit bad because you don't know when to stop.
Right. Why 151%? Where does that percentage come from?
Because everyone goes 100%. You want to be number one, you're going to go for 151.
There you
extra.
Go.
When no one's looking, you're going to do extra laps.
I'll remember that when I get to the next hill sprint later in the day. Scooter, how are you treated in society? Do people feel sorry for you? Because a lot of my mates that are in wheelchairs and traveling the world with wheelchair athletes as well, I remember being with Kurt Fearnley at times and people would see him on the street in his wheelchair and say, oh, my God, you know, I feel sorry for you and things like that. And, you know, for guys in a wheelchair, they're like, fuck, life is amazing. Like, why are you feeling sorry for it? They don't try to understand. And this isn't everyone. This is not a generalization of everyone. But I've experienced that from being beside athletes with a disability and, you know, working a lot with amputees as well. How have you been treated in society throughout your life?
It's everyone that knows me. It's, well, it's more like because of what I've done. Oh, like at the pool this week, I was saying to Herbie, my coach, I said it's good to see a lot of younger athletes coming up for a photo. Not, I don't care about that, but like they're inspiring to, well, people like me are inspiring the younger athletes to come do what we're doing because, you know, I was saying to another fellow today, I said, we're getting older, we're not going to last forever. But it's good to see the younger generation wanting to be like us and go and represent the country because, you know, once us older guys leave, someone needs to take our spot and pass it on. But then when you go, for example, when I'm at the shop at Coles at home, I'll be putting my groceries up on the conveyor belt and it looks like I'm struggling because the conveyor belt's at my hairline and I'm just whoop, whoop. And all the girls at Coles, I love going to Coles because I got all my mates, all the old ducks there and all the names and how are you, talk to them because everyone's like, why don't you just do online checkup? I said, what for? I don't get to see everyone and ask how they are, you know? It's people. I'm a people person. Anyway, I'll be throwing stuff up and there'll be someone who doesn't know me, what you just said, feel sorry for me. Oh, yeah, let me do that for you. I said, no, thank you, it's fine. But if you want to come help me, I've got some mopping at home to do. You can come mop the floors. Oh, no. But no, a lot of people that don't know me, well, yeah, feel sorry for me and they want to do it for you. But I sometimes have to grab my hand and say, no, sorry, it's fine, I can do it, you know. And then in there, some of them get a little bit offended sometimes, like, oh, I was just trying to help. I said, no, that's fine. But I've got it.
Mm.
Makes me feel human that I'm doing my own shopping. I said, if you go do it for me, how am I – not that I need to learn anymore. I've learned a lot from doing my own stuff, but I enjoy doing my own – just like I enjoy mowing my own lawn, you know what I mean? To me, when you get your own house, you mow your own lawn. That's when you know you're a man.
Two questions. How do you get the stuff from the higher shelves when you're getting around Coles before you get to the conveyor belt?
So if it's up high, like the chicken Kievs are up at 6 foot high, I'll find someone and I'll say, excuse me, do you mind? Well, normally if it's a random, I'll say, excuse me, can I borrow your height? And they're like, what? Need to borrow your height. Ah, yeah. And the staff, you know, she's like, what are you on about borrowing my height? And they'll grab it for me. But if it's like medium height where I climb up on my handlebars and I'm on one leg on the seat, one leg on the steering wheel, I can just grab it. But normally when it's, you know, at your probably elbow height, I'll ask someone because unless there's a ladder there, like at home I've got ladders everywhere, I'll climb up and do it.
Mm-hmm.
I do my own ceiling fans. People are like, what are you doing up there for? Why not?
And you mentioned handlebars and your nickname is Scooter. Tell us about the scooter that you get around on.
So when I was there's always scenarios about how am I going to get on in life? What am I going to get around on? Because when I was little, I had like a little plastic trike. And I think I was about 7 years old and we're at Brisbane visiting my grandparents. And there was a friend of my grandparents or someone that rocked up to my grandparents' house with pretty much the same, not that bike, but a trike like that, but all metal with wheels on it. And I've pretty much had one ever since. And even I remember when we were going into from primary school to high school, there was always conversation, is Grant going to be put into an electric wheelchair so he can, you know, meet people at eye level and stuff like that? And my parents pretty much said, let him do whatever he wants. Let him do what he's comfortable with. He wants to hop in the electric wheelchair, let him hop in. If he wants to buzz around on the bike, he can do that. But this bike, I'm a lot more independent than a lot of people that have their electric wheelchairs or there's people like me in America that have had 5 million operations on their back and joints. But that's why I haven't had that many operations is swimming. Swimming has been a lifesaver for me. The scooter has been around since I was 7. I'm now 33. And I don't think it'll go anywhere. This one here was actually made in 2011 or 10, the last year of my brother's schooling in grade 12. He did it in manual arts, and it's an aluminium one, and I've had it since then.
Yeah, Nick, that's
but
awesome.
I actually need a new one. It's falling apart.
Is it falling apart from the way that you just get around and chuck it in and out of the rental cars?
Yeah, it just gets used 24/7. Goes in the showers at the pool, goes everywhere.
Mm. It allows you to be mobile.
Yeah.
The other question that I was going to ask you about before is How do you mow your lawns? Do you have a ride-on mower?
I have a zero turn, which I got when I first got my house in 2015.
So what is it?
Zero turn. So it's like driving a bobcat. Right. You've got the handlebars. So you sit in the seat and your feet, obviously my feet aren't on the footrest, but then you got your hands on the handlebars and it's alternate steering a skid steer.
Yep.
So I do the lawn and then I'll go get my whippersnapper, do a little echo, and I watch one of my videos on the Instagram and you see me mowing, doing a whippersnapper with it around my head, holding it up here. And then when I do the driveway, I flip it on its side and do the edges. You know, and when I did that video, some people might not like me for saying this or get upset, but in the caption I said, who needs NDIS when you've got willpower? And what I like to create is people that are different. Where there's a will, there's a way. Don't rely on that safety card all the time. You know, do it yourself because you get something out of it when you do it yourself. You know, I do. And you feel like you're part of society and you've accomplished something.
Yeah, brilliant. And I like what you said there earlier too about, you see able-bodied people not being able to do certain things or not wanting to do things for themselves. So it's not a disability thing. It's just a human nature type thing. It's a mentality, a mindset, a victim mindset or I won't say laziness, but just that.
Laziness is part of it. I mowed an able-bodied lawn one time because he was too lazy and his missus was like, cannot believe you're mowing my fucking lawn and my husband is not doing it. Like, you know, but it's true. Laziness, the nature, the get up and go attitude's not there, and that's where my parents come in.
Well, when you said before about the you mowing the lawn, what I pictured straight away was those robot lawnmowers and you sitting on
that's
them.
Cheating.
Classic. So you live in Cairns, but you're here on the Gold Coast for National Swimming Champs. How has your comp been? I know it's just the beginning. And what does this comp set you up for? What's on the horizon with this?
So these trials are selection trials for the World Champs in Manchester in August. And start of this week's been going all right. I've still got the beard on, as you can see, but this will come off.
What does that mean?
Well, it's part of my training regime. So it's drag.
Okay.
And then the main event's on Thursday, the 150 AM and 50 breast. It'll all be off by then.
Okay. Mm. So we're sitting here on a Tuesday at the moment. If I had you in here on Thursday, you wouldn't have a beard.
I'll look naked.
Right. There you go.
17 again.
Trim it all off.
Gornskis.
Yeah, right.
So smooth. But and I only do it for swimming. Obviously, when I go to talk like last year, well, after Tokyo, I was keeping it trim when I go to talks because it's a lot more presentable and I don't look like a caveman, but yeah.
Well, I'm glad I captured the caveman before it comes off.
I'm like, no, you'll appreciate it.
But with the swimming, also one thing that you said was swimming has saved your life.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned other people that have a lot of operations. Obviously, those Ironmans and running a lot isn't good for your body, but the swimming is obviously really good for your condition.
Yeah. I first started I did learn to swim like everyone else. But I remember when I was little, the doctors would say, oh, swimming is good for him. He should continue it. Maybe not competitive, but always do it because it's going to help him to be more mobile in life. And I remember when I was a little kid, I was like, no, I want to play football and cricket. And obviously, as I grew up, you know, my parents also made me realize, you know, they gave me the harsh truth, like, Grant, you know, you're like 11 or whatever I was. You can play backyard cricket on the street and kick a football at lunch at school, whatever, but to participate with people like you, it's not going to work, you know. And at the time, it was probably sad and daunting, but it was good in a way that, you know, give you the harsh truth without someone else laughing at you on a football field or a cricket pitch saying, oh, what's he doing on me? You know what I mean? Still participate, still be around it, support it. But that's when, obviously, it went more towards swimming. And I first started competitive swimming when I was 11. And I did it for 2 years. And in those 2 years, I had goals. Short-term goal was to go to States And mid-term goal was nationals, and then the long-term goal was to represent Australia at the Paralympics. And this was back in 2000. So I was aiming for 2004 Paralympics. Anyway, 2002, my head coach, Adam Luscombe, left and back to Melbourne. And because he left and I was different, I thought that no one else would be able to coach me because I was so different. And I did, my mum also described it as a little bit depressed when he left. I also had, not that this would affect me now, but I had bad ear infections and a bit of a shoulder problem, but obviously I wasn't motivated like I am now, where stuff like that, I let it fly over the shoulder. So I took 5 years off. I come back in 2007, mainly because I looked like Jabba the Hutt of Star Wars. I was huge. I was 65 kilos.
At 3 foot?
Yeah, 3'10". It was bad. And I remember I used to catch a taxi home from school to home. And I'd sit there and I'd think about back in the day when I used to swim when I was 11. And I was like, I need to do something, you know. I got mates that are doing well in other sports and I'm doing nothing. And I think there was a moment at the end of grade 12 where I was like, I need to lose some weight. Well, I'm not finding any ladies looking like this and I'm not doing anything with myself. So that's when I started swimming by myself in 2007 and then ran into Herbie in September 2007 and originally said, how about we chase that dream of representing your country at the Paralympics when you're a little kid? I said, oh, I don't know about that. That's 7 sessions a week, 5 a.m. start. I thought about it for 2 weeks and then went there. And then we had 6 months until Beijing trials and went to Beijing. That was my first national, so that was another goal kicked off. And I remember I missed out on the team by 1.5 seconds. And I remember the head coach of the Australian swim team at the time, BK, Brendan Teo, he come up and said, hang in there for London. You know, look what you've done in 6 months. Give it 4 years. And, yeah, the rest was history.
Rest was history. There we were crossing paths at London Paralympics. What is it that you take from your swimming into everyday life that allows you to function more optimally as well? So you have a job outside of your swimming.
Yep.
What does that look like for you?
So my week is very busy. I do 9 sessions training, 7 swim, 2 gym. And Monday, we'll do Monday because Monday is a big day. Monday morning swim and then I finish, so 5:30 to 7:30 and then I go to work about 8:30. Finish work at 5 and then go to gym at like 5:15 until like 6:30. The rest of the week is very similar. And it's just when I get to Saturday, so Saturdays we normally work every second or third Saturday. So if I'm not working, I knock off at 9 o'clock because that's when I finish swimming. Well, sorry, 8 o'clock. And if I am working, well, I don't finish till 12 on a Saturday. And that pretty much gives me like, I don't know, 36 hours or something of free time. And then it's back in the burner for next week. And I think, you know, when you want to do amazing things in life, you got to be committed and stay true to your beliefs. And I think the part of swimming that I use, well, swimming and my everyday life, I tell this to people all the time. I said, if you're lazy in one area in part of your life, it's going to come across to the other things. So if you give everything, you know, 150%, it's going to be easier to maintain that motivation and mentality to keep doing everything so well. But obviously, you know, I'm getting a lot older now. I've been around for a while and it is getting harder, but we'll just take every year as it comes for now. Paris is definitely on the cards next year.
So you only trained for 6 months and you missed Beijing 2008,
mm-hmm.
Stuck with it, trusted it, believed it, qualified and made the 2012.
First world champs was 2010, went to Eindhoven.
Okay, so you made world champs 2010, did Paralympics 2012.
Yep.
How was your journey then through to and up for the trials for Rio?
So let's quickly talk about London quickly. When I went to London, I was ranked second in the world going in for my main event, the 150 IM. And so my
what's IM for everyone listening?
150 individual medley, so 50 back, 50 breast, 50 free. No butterfly because I can't do it. I'd love to do it, it's cool, but my shoulders don't come out. So that's normally with the lower classes, they miss a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
So they might do butterfly but can't do breaststroke or something.
Gotcha.
Anyway, so I was ranked second in the world for that going into it from Parapan Packs in 2011. And so I felt, obviously, I was 21, I felt pretty confident going to go to London and hopefully win a Paralympic medal. And then, you know, all these doors are going to open, more speaking, more of this, and everyone's going to love me because I've got a Paralympic medal. First day of competition in London, I had the 50 breaststroke. And when I went out to race, I got distracted. And distracted by me looking at the rest of the field. And I've come a long way since then. But I was looking at, obviously, in Paralympic sport, it's never going to be fair. As you know, you've been a masseuse on the team, you know, Paralympics has got all different classifications. Anyway, long story short, I was caught up in the process of looking at the other athletes, why they're in my class, and me quickly calculating in my head going, this is going to wreck my chances in the IM. Like, these guys went here last year and all of a sudden they've rocked up. And, yeah, I lost it. And I ended up swimming a crap race in the 50 breaststroke, missed out on the final. And I remember I got to talk to Jason Patchell. You might remember him.
Of course.
He was a
sports psychologist.
Yeah, amazing sports psychologist.
I've snowboarded many mountains with Jace. We travelled with the Winter Paralympic team together.
He's a great bloke.
Yeah, legend.
Awesome. And I'll be honest, he helped change my my direction of how I was thinking in a couple of days. We talked about Scooter, you know. You think about these Chinese and Ukrainian athletes in your class. You don't think they should be there, but it is what it is. Everyone back home, they're not gonna worry about that. They just care, like all your friends and family, they care about that you've given it 151% in training. Whatever happens, happens. Your speaking commitments, that'll still be there. There'll be different stories for you to tell. But he said, what you need to focus on is executing your race plan correctly, and whatever happens, happens. You can't change history. You can't redirect the path. It is what it is. If you spend all your good energy worrying about who's in the class and who's not, well, you're wasting your time and you might as well not be here. So that's when I regrouped and ended up doing a PB in the final in the IM, and I came sixth. So let's move now to Rio. After London, I got some resilience training about, you know, not trying to control the uncontrollable. Rio, 4 years later, so we're getting ready to win a medal. We went to London, we were a tourist, and now Rio, we want a medal. So I do trials, do similar times to, obviously, London, but because similar situation to London, there was more of these athletes in my class that it's debatable of where they should be or not. And it bumped me out to seventh. So I actually missed out on the team altogether. And you could just imagine, you know, 8 years in the making, my dream of winning a Paralympic medal is literally gone because I'm not even on the team. And I remember when I got the phone call saying, Stula, because I was first reserve or whatever, sorry, mate, yeah, the team is full and you're not going to be required to be a part of the team. You've missed out. And obviously you felt bad. And I was very angry at the time at the world. And I remember getting home after work that day and I was talking to my parents and I said, Grant, you've got two options. You can ring up a car and fare, whatever you want to do, and scream from the top of the mountain and be remembered as that whinging midget. Or number two, go back to work, not knowing if that dream will ever come true of you winning a Paralympic medal or going to Tokyo. Who knows what will happen? That's a long way away. But if it does, think about the story you could tell. Ba-dum, ba-dum. Tokyo, obviously. COVID come, waited an extra year. But a 13-year-old dream that come true, you know, in the click of a finger at Tokyo, where I won first Paralympic medal in the IM bronze and then the silver medal in the 50 breast 2 days later. I was on cloud nine. And how lucky was I for having my two parents saying, you got two options, cry and be remembered for a whinging loser, or two, go and chase that dream, not knowing if you'll get there or not, but think about the story. And that's what's created great motivational speaking for me to tell now, because the resilience and the commitment that I had to hold on, you know, since London all the way to Tokyo. And now I'm just chasing more icing on top of cake. I've already done plenty of damage.
I love that story. And it's great for the listeners too, who might not have athletic desires, but it's that reminder that that kick in the guts, that challenge, that sign that said, you know what, here's an opportunity for you to stop and change trajectory, or build that resilience physically, mentally, yep, emotionally, and continue on. And the hard thing that a lot of people listening wouldn't understand is with the classification system in Paralympic sport, that's what you're referring to, is we would often go to a World Champs or a Paralympic Games and not know who was going to be. You might see the names, but you don't know how they've performed because they could be classified not long before. Classification systems can change. People come and go from the sport very differently. So even for you to say after Rio 2016, what your parents said is awesome, that tough love again, for you to say, actually, yeah, you know what, I'm going to knuckle down and I'm going to give it a crack towards Tokyo in 4 years. It ended up being 5 years' time. Yeah. You didn't know what's going to happen in Tokyo. Like, is there going to be another classification thing where you rock up and then all of a sudden you might not even make a final again because of the people in – yeah. Yep. So it's credit to you then for sticking to that path with that unknown of – it doesn't matter how well you train and performed. That's kind of the easy part. Turn up, train hard, recover well, train hard, recover well, go to all the competitions. So many things are out of your control. Yeah. And I heard you mention it before too. What's this – learning curve for you, and how do you bring it into life now with the focusing on the controllables, not focusing on what you can't control?
Well, everything you do in life, if there's something out of your control, like obviously is some people are having a barney over something, if it's got nothing to do with you, let it slide. Focus on your path. Like for me, I'm wanting to do a lot more in speaking, so focus on that. Don't focus on the negatives. If there's something wrong, let it go. Do something else. And I tell all the other athletes that are on the team, you know, if it's not working for you, find something else that you want to do. Like, I never had to keep doing swimming. I could have done something else, but I chose to. I was not giving up. And obviously, if I never went to Tokyo and never got a medal, well, I would have went down because I went down for trying, at least. You know what I mean? I gave it a go.
How often in your daily life are you faced with things that are out of your control that you could focus on and complain about and be derailed by rather than focusing on what you can control?
Like I
was just going to say, I saw a few as soon as you arrived here.
Correct. Like small things. I'll be at work. It's a similar thing like my kitchen. I've got a stool on wheels, on a lift. If I drop something, I'm serving someone,
So you work in customer service?
Yes, yes. Yeah. I'm on the front line. And if I drop something, it's a pain in my ass because I have to go over to the end, hop on my bike, hop on my scooter, go back to the thing, pick up whatever the paper or whatever it is, put it up there, go back to the stool, hop on the stool and slide back over. Where you squat down and grab it. Little things like that. And sometimes I might have done a couple of things in a row, and I'll say to people, don't ever be a midget, it's too hard. Be able bodied. But that's just part of me letting steam off, I guess.
Yeah, well said. How often with people that you, when you do your motivational speaking, do they come to you and say, I'm really inspired now? Or actually, let's drop the inspiration. That's the word I would hope that they would get. But how often do people come and say to you, you've made me realise how much I need to get off my ass, or you've made me realise, okay, I'm just going to do this. You've brought a bit of strength out in me. How often do you get that kind of feedback?
Oh, all the time. One time I had a full-grown man in his 40s come up and cry in front of me. And I said, mate, it's all right. He said, oh, no, but I don't give a go, and just watching you, I feel like a hopeless person. And I said, mate, let today be the day where you turn your life around, like what I did at Rio, and start something new or go on a different trajectory. I said, every day is a new beginning. I said, I'm just here to make you realise that you can go and chase whatever you want to chase. That's all my job is. But now you, no one's going to do it for you, just like when I've decided to go to Tokyo. I had to do it. My parents didn't do it for me. They just said, oi, there's a path over here. Why don't you look at that path? I looked at the path. I said, but you have to commit to it and go do it. A lot of people come up and always for a photo and talk to me about, oh, it's touching and inspiring. But I said, oh, well, I hope you can get something out of it and go and fulfill your journey in life. Because that means more to me is people being better in life or contributing to the planet and being a good person.
Is that kind of your mission now beyond Paralympic sport?
Is to help all the next generation get off their phones so much and go out and achieve goals. It might not be sport, it might be art, drama, news, whatever it is they want to do. But go and do it. Stop sitting there sliding up and down. You know, I see at the pool young kids, they just live on their phones. Go and make something to show someone to go, wow.
Yeah, well said. Speaking of wow, if the 40-year-old man who came up to you crying is watching or listening to this, I would love to hear from you. Reach out and let us know what action you took after that chat with Scooter, because if that wasn't enough to shake it up, where you pretty much said to him, mate, draw the line in the sand, everything that's happened, past experiences, don't define you. What happens from here on in is what will define you. This is your opportunity.
And you're better off in life focusing on the things that you can do and creating a positive vibe around you and going and reaching your goals instead of worrying about things that you can't do.
Love that. I'm going to read a little quote to you that I saw on your Instagram from Oscar Wilde, and I'd love to know what it means to you and how you anchor into it in your life. It says, if a thing is worth doing, it is worth doing well. If it is worth having, it is worth waiting for. If it is worth attaining, it is worth fighting for. If it is worth experiencing, it is worth putting time aside for.
That's pretty much the 13 years of my life. You know what I mean? From London to Tokyo, I really wanted something. And to do a full-time sport, as you know, it's not easy to give up mornings and nights for your sport. You know, there's being a 20-year-old, 30-year-old, there's so much more to do in life. You know, go out parties and have fun with mates, look for girls, you know, all that stuff comes up. And there's a lot of people I know that are more interested in doing that, so their sporting career hasn't gone the way mine has, but that's their choice. But what in that quote, anything you put time into, normally good things come. Not all the time, like, for example, Rio, if you read that to me, like, oh, well, it still hasn't come. But I was persistent with it and stuck in there. And obviously, I know, not lucky, but in a way, sort of, yeah. But I was there ready to take it when it was shown in front of me.
Powerful. And it's in alignment with your philosophies around everything, but what that means to me when I hear that, when I read that on your quote, I thought, because when I first read it, I thought, oh, you wrote that. And then it's come from, well written, mate. You're a poet. But then
I don't even know it.
But knowing your actions, your behaviours, your mindset, really, like, it's about this optimism. It's about this. It's not even a go get it attitude. It's kind of that use adversity to your advantage. Mm. And what I believe that everyone listening to this and would get also when you're speaking live is that inspiration. So one thing that I've noticed being with Paralympic athletes I worked in Paralympic sport for almost 15 years, and similar to what I was saying there with Kurt before, you get two sides of the coin where people are either inspired by you or they compare and say, oh, my life isn't as bad as yours, therefore I should do this, as opposed to I'm inspired. Like, if you can do that, I'm inspired to take more action, not in that comparison and putting themselves down. Mm. Do you get that a little bit sometimes?
Yeah. But you just gotta obviously, like the people in the shop, be able to explain to them, give them help. Because then it also helps them. Like, it might be a mum trying to help me, and if I've done what I did, saying, I'm fine, thanks, I can do it myself, it might make them go, maybe I shouldn't do that for my kid all the time. Maybe I should let them have a go. So I've just done something, even though I didn't even know. I know now. But you know what I mean?
It's small that things. Indirect influence. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Mate, we're going to wrap up shortly, but I'd like to ask all my guests, in alignment with the unbeatable philosophy, so unbeatable you is, the unbeatable philosophies are around this understanding that in life we are not immune to adversities, big ones, and also the daily challenges, the small challenges, any challenges in our life. In actual fact, because we're human, we're going to experience them more. And the programs that I run and the way that I work with people is around this unbeatable philosophies, is that it's tools and strategies and mindsets to help us navigate these challenges, to help us navigate adversities so that we're not beaten by them. And you're a prime example of this, of how you use this. So what I'd love to hear from you is, what's one or two things that you'd like to leave with the listeners to help them understand how they could start to design and live their own unbeatable lives?
Well, first of all, don't focus on the negatives. Focus on what you can do. Stop controlling the uncontrollable. Get out there in life and have a crack. Nothing's too big or hard to go and try and do. If it doesn't work, we're going to try something else. And have a never give up attitude. That's pretty much how I've gotten through life. You know, everything I do, fishing, go-karting, heaps of stuff I do in life. Never give up. Like when I did the Ironman, people straight away assume, how's he going to touch the ground? How's he going to reach the pedals? Where there's a will, there's a way. And I think by me just, I think I really, I know I'm a bit of a storyteller, but me doing things in life helps, like, helps people to look at something going, oh, if Scooter's riding a bike or if Scooter's doing that, maybe I can have a crack at doing this. I had one of my good mates come up to me and I was very touched by this because I think highly of him. He's a close mate and he's done well at uni and he's set himself up in life very well. And he came up and said to me, when I got back from Tokyo, I had this big welcoming parade in Cairns. And he came up and said, you see, your speech about the cards, he said, it made me realise, like, you know, his job he's doing, he's making plenty of money, he's set up, got a nice house, nice car, whatever. He said, but inside, I'm bored. And he said, with listening to what you said, he said, I'm going to go try something else. And now he's going and flying helicopters, got his helicopter licence. But hearing him open up, and, you know, it's hard to have a 30-year-old male come and talk to another male and say how he felt. You know, that's a hard thing these days. I get a lot of people say, how do you talk about your parents so openly? But it's true. But to have him come up and say that, that was, like, pretty touching for me. Meanwhile, it's just a thing in my head that I always say when I do talking. But I know it means, but you know what I mean? It's touching. But things I do help people redirect their life to do something that makes their brain tick again, not just, you know, you do your same job for so over many years and it's the same thing over and over. But all of a sudden you see a life event or something happens and you go, I'm going to try professional dolphin keeping or something, you know. I'm going to be a pianist.
A pianist. I've heard that you don't mind the piano.
I started in COVID, but I've been a bit lazy. I do too much stuff, but I really do like piano. Elton John and Chris Martin have inspired me.
Right.
I just love being able to play something. And I smile myself when I can get it down pat.
So that you're feeling connected to it. You're getting energy from it. You're loving what you're doing there.
I love music.
Do you love swimming?
I've paused too long. I love keeping fit and training hard. Racing, I don't know, I'm getting older now and it's getting harder, but I guess I do like racing when it's a close, right? Like, for example, me and Ahmed, he's on the Paralympic team as well. When it's someone similar like me, I love it because that's like why I got into go-kart racing too. It's more of a level playing field. But my whole life, it's hard for me to verse someone that's the same as me because there's no one like me that I can race against. You know what I mean? But no, I do obviously, I do love it in some respects because I'm still training my ass off and I don't know when to stop. But yeah, I think obviously there'll come a time where I'll let it go and obviously do more of the motivational speaking stuff and help other people do better with themselves.
It's just an interesting perspective with a lot of people in sport as you get towards the end of your career. I'm not sure how many years you got left in you. Maybe you'll stick around to Brisbane 2032. And
I told my coach and my PT that, but oh, mate, it's getting harder and harder. I don't know how I'll do it. But I've penciled it in.
It's in the calendar. It's scheduled in. It's going to happen. But that love piece, it's a different sort of love. Like you design your life around it and it becomes a part of who you are and what you do, just a part of that. It's not all that you are, but that love that you feel from playing the piano is different to a love for the love for the training, the love for the camaraderie, the love for the competition. It's a different kind of love.
And like often people will say, how do you keep the motivation to do your 9 sessions week in, week out? And I ask myself the same thing. But there's a little mongrel inside that obviously when the alarm goes off at 4:50, it's just like I'm sitting there like, oh, it's too cold or something. I just want to stay in bed. But there's this little mongrel inside that just like grabs my shirt and says, get up, we need to go do this. And when that little thing leaves me, that's when it'll be the day when I say goodbye because it's that thing inside that drives me. It's weird to explain. It's not actually me. It's this little thing inside that wants success so bad.
Is that why you refer to yourself as we? When you were telling stories earlier of we and then you said, and I was on my own at that big hill and I was like, oh, okay. So now you're referring to that we is the little mongrel and you.
It's a mongrel inside that pushes me. And on a Sunday, he's asleep, the little mongrel, and I literally do nothing. I'm like a lazy potato.
And you don't stir him with a stick?
No, I sit there on the couch and watch movies and go, maybe I should take the dogs for a run on the quad or, you know, like, oh, I'd have to wash the quad. Especially a full week of work and training. I'm knackered. But, yeah, but when you fire him up, he's ready to rock and roll.
Everyone needs that little mongrel inside of them. And to follow more of what you do, where's the best place to watch and be inspired by? You've mentioned Instagram a couple of times.
My Skrila page on Facebook. You see the YouTube videos. I probably need to do more stuff, but I'm someone, like I was saying before, I want people to do less of the swiping, more creative. I like to do more creating and, you know, show, like I did a video of me mowing a lawn and I've got another one coming out soon, probably me cleaning the shed gutters on my 4-metre shed, you know, with a cherry picker. Shit like that. I like showing people that, like, there's a will, there's a way. At the same time, I'm not someone to, like, boast about myself, but I understand me doing little things like that in life helps people do their stuff. But I'm definitely not one to, you know, do selfies in the mirror and stuff like that. That's probably the bit that I need to learn more is how to be more proactive with promoting myself. But obviously time will come.
Just get someone to capture everything that you do. If people were watching you come up here, up the stairs, into the studio.
What I need is a personal videographer. That's with me 24/7 and that would be a show itself.
There you go.
Student's home videos.
Putting it out there. Maybe we'll have a live show with you coming out soon.
Netflix can get on, you know, they got Michael Jordan Last Dance where they can have the last swim, 2032. Turn his lights off. Drop the mic.
There we go. Anyone who knows anyone at Netflix, let's get this happening. That's brilliant. Scooter, before we wrap up, do you have any questions for me?
What drives you in life to do what you're doing at the moment?
Yeah, good question. At the moment is very different to previously and I've been through different phases in my life. I was driven a lot as a coach in early days to be the best coach that I could be and knowing that kind of ripple effect, and especially working in Paralympic sport, I was really driven to hit my potential as a coach because I could see the great things that I was doing with my athletes, but I also had mentors that were 20 plus years older and doing amazing things. So that really drove me. I experienced major adversity at the end of 2014 when my grandparents were tragically murdered in their home, and that took me on a different trajectory. And so that really drove me. That's what started this podcast. That drove me then to want to make more of an impact, to be more aligned, to enhance and optimize their legacy. Now I'm a father and I'm driven to help design a life for my family that creates resilience, abundance, and opportunity. And opportunity to me is like opportunity to travel, opportunity to choose, opportunity to be in tribes in the middle of a wilderness in South America and learn in that kind of way. So I'm kind of driven to provide those opportunities. But in my work, I'm consistently driven to – part of my purpose is to help impact the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. Significantly impact the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. Hence why I love the podcast and bringing on legends like yourself and with the coaching that I do. So that's what really drives me. I'd say that I kind of measure my success on the ripple effect of the people that I work with. So yes, it's great to see people get results in their mindset, their health, their emotional intelligence, their relationships are enhanced. And what I love hearing about is how that impacts their family positively or their community or their business and their employees or their charities or anything like that. So that's what really drives me in this phase of my life.
It's really good to hear. Like I said at the start, we all have choices, and I think you're making some awesome choices to try and make an impact on the earth and make people think differently. That's good.
Thanks, mate.
Thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Likewise.
Well worth the drive.
All the way from Cairns. Yeah. Scooter, you're a legend. I want to acknowledge you for your resilient and abundant mindset and your just attitude for life, for just getting after it. I think that if we all woke up every day with that little mongrel inside of us and showed up with that resilience and that abundance, then we would all be not just achieving more but enjoying life and we'd be a lot more connected species.
Find you're in the mongrel. Never give up.
There we go. Keep shining your impactful and abundant light to the world, my man.
Thank you.
Boom.
Boom. Drop
good
the mic.
Good stuff. Drop the mic. There you go, another empowering episode, and thanks again for tuning in. Make sure you check out the show notes for any extra links or information that we spoke about in this episode. Don't forget you can now catch the Unbeatable You podcast on the YouTube channel, Brett Robbo Coach. If you want info and inspiration straight into your inbox on how to live an unbeatable life, you can sign up to receive weekly insights and actionable steps for optimal performance and thriving in every aspect of your life. Plus, first release offers on Unbeatable You courses and live events. Don't worry, there's no spam, just short, punchy, value-giving emails straight to you. Simply go to brettrobbo.com/community. If you find value in this podcast, don't forget to share it around with your mates and subscribe, rate, and review. It really supports the podcast mission massively. If you want to reach out to me personally, you can connect with me at Brett Robbo Coach on social media, and that's where you can let me know who you want to hear on the show. Keep thriving, legends, and as always, remember, if not you, then who? If not now, then when? This is your opportunity to live your unbeatable life.